Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. Edgy Ideas is proudly sponsored by the Eco Leadership Institute. We offer coach and leadership training courses, and we have a vibrant community of practice where international members join once a month for a webinar. Our focus is on co-creating the good society. To find out more, go to www.ecoleadershipinstitute.org, and to read my polemic blogs and essays, go to Simon Western at Substack. Thank you for listening. Welcome, everybody, to this edition of Edgy Ideas Podcast. Today, I have two special guests, an old friend and colleague, Professor Jonathan Gosling, and welcome to Dr. Stephanie Jones. Jonathan acts as an advisory capacity for leadership-related projects in commercial, governmental, and activist organizations, applying leadership thinking to the social good. He has been professor of leadership at renowned universities across the world. He's internationally renowned for his leadership practice as well, leadership development, and he's a keynote speaker on leadership, power, and change. Dr. Stephanie Jones is Associate Professor of Org Behavior at Maastricht School of Management, having graduated with a PhD from University College London. Stephanie has authored over 25 full-length internationally published books on business and management, three of them with Jonathan. She teaches MBA students across the world, especially courses on leadership, culture, and change. Jonathan and Stephanie, you are very welcome to Edgy Ideas. How are you both doing today?
Great. Thank you very much for inviting us, Simon.
Good. Yeah, thank you. Very well.
It's exciting. We're going to talk about a very famous leader, one of the apparently a leader who's had more books written on him than anybody else in the world. Maybe except for Jesus and somebody else. I think there's
Hitler.
Jesus and Hitler. Yeah, number three on the top list. So, and you've added to that list. You've written a book on Napoleon, looking at power. Is that right?
Yeah. So it was the study in power. I mean, we've done quite well with this book on Admiral Lord Nelson, and we were under pressure from various people to write a book about Napoleon when his anniversary came round in 2015. And we sat down and decided that we needed to develop a perspective, a kind of lens through which to try to understand Napoleon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, you know, how he could take an army to Moscow, the complete failure, and, you know, take 500,000 soldiers and horses and lose most of them on the way back. And then call up another army. We thought, well, how did he do this? Because lots of it doesn't make sense. So we thought there must be power in it somewhere.
Yeah. Well, I hadn't done a lot of research on Napoleon, but I got interested and I went to see the film, and I sat at the front of the cinema on one of these sofa beds, and I looked up at the screen, and there was this huge epic battles going on, and like war after war after war. But I was actually very interested in the portrayal of Napoleon and how it portrayed vulnerabilities alongside great power. I mean, these things interested me. And I wonder what your thoughts were on that, Jonathan, on the actual film. Let's start with the film.
Well, a film was, you know, a blockbuster in the sense of the enormity of the scale of everything. And I thought it did deal quite well with the sense of how puzzled he was to have fallen into this relationship, to find a sort of need of his with Josephine. And I think that aspect of it was probably quite close to, at least I've come to understand him. And although the film, I thought, gave us no sense of the passion, and I couldn't really understand why the interdependency between them turned out so strong. It didn't give me an understanding of that, looking at the movie. But I think there was that in real life. And, you know, the fact that there was a kind of tight-knit connection that was very hard for either of them to untangle was probably quite right. It's said that he used to, at times of high stress, not necessarily not military stress, but administrative load and exhaustion, and when he was really sort of struggling to maintain this enormous and manage this enormous empire across Europe, he used to kind of sort of cuddle up into her lap and hide himself and his and sort of and yes, and I think this sort of strange noise he used to make in the movie, he was shown making in the movie, was quite accurate in that he apparently he used to, she used to coo at him like a mother hen or something.
So turning to your book, let's say something about this power. I mean, it was the enormity of the power and the choice of becoming an emperor. I mean, what was going on for not just Napoleon, because there's never a leader is always part of a social context, isn't it? And I thought the film did quite a nice job just by starting it kind of with the revolution and just kind of pointing to the turmoil. I thought that was interesting. Just to share your reflections on kind of what was going on around power and Nelson and the context.
Well, for me, you know, you mentioned vulnerabilities. I mean, Napoleon's great hang-up, there's nothing to do with the Napoleon complex being short. I mean, that's a propaganda from the Brits. But it was like being a Corsican, being a peasant, not being an aristocrat. And he desperately wanted to join the club of the crowned heads of Europe and be accepted by them. And he never was, not even by his father-in-law, you know, the Austrian emperor. And everybody deserting him at his moment of need. And he thought he'd started to build ways to reduce that vulnerability. But actually, at the end, he hadn't. He was a hero to zero.
Yeah, there's something about... I mean, I really liked the portrayal of him, and I don't know how accurate or inaccurate it was, but I actually thought it was a good study of someone with immense power and immense kind of fragility and two things actually feeding each other.
He had a strange sort of start in life. His mother, when she was pregnant with him, was part of a band of resistance fighters against the Genoese occupation of Corsica, and she had a toddler and was pregnant, and they were living in the hills and fighting a sort of partisans struggle, and at some point the Genoese asked for help and then gave or were obliged to give over this occupation to the French, who came with much more organization and energy. And at that point, the partisans were defeated or recognized that it was a losing battle. And I think she, his mother, reckoned, "I've had enough of this, living up in the hills with a toddler and being pregnant, expecting another." And they kind of made their peace with the French occupation, while many of their pals took an amnesty and were sailed off and actually took refuge in Britain. In those early years, as a freedom fighter, independence fighter, who had decided to come to some arrangement, an accommodation with the new occupiers, I guess they were, as a family, they were in a sort of in between zone. Many people would have seen them as collaborators. Yeah. With an occupying force, okay. And they were in a way, and they in fact came to benefit. I don't know if he experienced it as a benefit, but he was sponsored by the incoming governor as a 9-year-old boy to go off to boarding school in France in a language he didn't really know and very much on his own. And it was in that boarding school really that he became. He began to identify with, he had to identify as French and with the French struggle. But he started off in this very sort of marginal world.
Yeah. You write in your book, you mention charisma, quite a lot about charisma, and clearly he had something. In the film, it didn't really show what that charisma was. Mm. It showed kind of the immense power and kind of what he, you know, these huge kind of armors he managed to get up and his popularity around, amongst some of the French. But I didn't get a clear sense of kind of what this charisma was. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, it didn't come over in the movie. It was a bit disappointing. At the moment when the troops are sent to stop his advance on Paris when he comes back from Elba, and they're supposed to shoot him or arrest him and all, and he convinces them to why would you wouldn't kill your emperor. It wasn't totally convincing, but at the time he was able to do this, especially with the relationships he built with many of the soldiers and his rousing speeches. We didn't really get a sense of that in the movie.
No. You know, because I write on, my themes of leadership, one of them being Messiah leadership, and clearly he'd fit into that Messiah controller bracket. He was, that's kind of how he led. But what that actually means in practice is quite interesting, and how we see echoes of that in contemporary life. I'm interested in how charisma is utilized today in organizations and in politics. I wonder if you have any thoughts on links.
Yeah, I think he, one thing did come through from the movie was his sort of bias for action and his real energy and desire to plunge in to chaotic situations and kind of create some order around him. And I think perhaps unconsciously that's a big part of charisma. If people are sort of casting about for something to... some sort of magnetic pole for a psychic alignment, and he had that ability and desire to do that. But also, he was very careful to manufacture the elements, as it were, of charisma, including his own imagery. We did see in the movie the painter David being sort of commissioned to make these dramatic representations of the scenes he was in, and make them, in some ways, referring to classical heroic figures and poses and so on. Like he's on this charging, this rearing horse about to conquer the Alps, which was so different in reality. He was dragged over there on a mule, so it was. And I guess that sense of that, and of course manipulating the media, and we saw in the movie how upset he was by the British media, which took him down, as it were, as they still do in the tabloid press with anybody like that. But he really got to control the French media very directly in the latter parts of his career.
That's interesting, isn't it? Branding, marketing, creating, turning the narrative, the storyboard is kind of goes way back in history, and he obviously kind of utilized that. I think the point you're making when people talk about charisma, they often think about kind of psychology and personality and stuff, but I think that link to attaching charisma to an object of desire is interesting, so his own object of desire to come out of this peasant life and be an emperor and be recognized by the other, whoever his kind of other was, whether that was the French people or the peers he thought should be his peers, the kings and the queens and the powerful.
Yes, there were these in the movie, it was there, and it's definitely the case in his life that he wanted very much to be recognized as an emperor by other emperors, and he felt his equals ought to have been Alexander of Russia and Francis of Austria-Hungary. But I think the core object of desire in his life was his mother, and that was also represented in the movie. And in fact, in the coronation scene where he crowned himself in effect and then crowned Josephine, and you saw in the background a row of women standing there against a green Bay's background. One of them was his mother. And the interesting thing is his mother in real life wasn't actually there. She was down in Marseille at the time of his coronation, but he had her painted in, photoshopped into the picture, as it were, because he so wanted to perform this in front of her. And we did hear his brother Lucien a few times saying to him in the movie, you know, mother wouldn't like it.
Yeah. Actually, I was fascinated reading quite a big article in the Times, in the Weekend FT by Simon Sharma. And he made the point about Napoleon looting all the art treasures wherever he went. And the Louvre in Paris is just full of Napoleon's looted treasures. And that was all part of him creating a longer term legacy. Mm. And he commissioned pictures, not just David, but that one in Jaffa with fever and an epidemic going on. And he would touch the sufferers from the plague like he was godlike character who could heal people. Yeah. I think that was all part of his imagery of building up this legend.
Yeah. I mean, we hear a lot about narcissistic leaders, egoistic leaders, and probably we hear too much about it. It's probably it's a very populist kind of a way of talking about leadership without much depth. But I'm wondering kind of what your thoughts are on this relationship to Josephine's kind of really intriguing me. This pairing, you know, in psychoanalytic kind of language, we go to beyond and we think about kind of what pairing means. And Jonathan and I have worked a lot on pairing when we were doing our leadership exchanges, how we really realizing the power of pairs and that really changes someone's, like, it's not just their intrapsychic kind of personality. There's something which happens when a pair comes together, some kind of imaginary hope or something comes from it. Do you want to say a bit more about that, perhaps?
It was interesting, the balance between the domination aspects of it, because Napoleon wants Josephine to say, tell me you're nothing without me.
Yeah.
And then about 10 minutes later, it's the other way around. So it's like this domination balance.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that was a very powerful part of the movie, how she kind of switched that and, like, no, you know, the power is not with you. The power is kind of here as well, and I've got plenty of it. I thought that was quite interesting.
But then how the possibility of maintaining that as a kind of public official pair when they didn't have a child over and over, and the whole sort of urgency shifted towards finding another partner for him who could create a dynastic mm-hmm. continuity. Now you mention it, Simon, it is very much as if through the revolution and the regicide of the king and queen, France was casting about for a reborn sort of messianic leader. And I think in your terminology that he was undoubtedly that. And in many ways, it was realized. He did, mm-hmm. or at least was part of the movement that brought order after dreadful disorder, and it was pretty perilous. And when he went off to Egypt, all the chit chat amongst the as we saw this in the council brought chaos back again. On his way back from Egypt, as he was traveling up from the south coast, the leading military general with his baggage and his guard were attacked and robbed by bandits on the road up from the south. Yeah. There was a real breakdown in law and order across metropolitan France. And he was the person, there were many others who wanted him, but he was the person who made it happen. And I think in that sense, he embodied perhaps the messianic leader. After a while, that messianic energy to unite, bring together the whole of Europe and beyond, was just so totally unrealistic and unrecognizing the other drives and urges and identities possible. And then the pairing pushed upon him with when he was really sort of made to go and look for someone else.
I was thinking about, why was it that he wasn't sustainable? But in a way, the cult of Napoleon has never really gone. And the French people still say, well, France was great then in the time of Napoleon. And I went to Ajaccio in Corsica. There's a huge museum about Napoleon at his birthplace. But it was completely hijacked by Napoleon III in taking over this cult of Napoleon at the same reason, almost, because you had the collapse again in France, you had the war against Germany, Franco-Prussian war, you had the Paris Commune, and you had a kind of Napoleonic scene again, and then you had this brief emergence of Napoleon III. So it's like that dynasty reappeared, and who knows, may reappear again at a time of chaos. Because they still hold a candle to Napoleon in France.
Yeah, and it's not just in France, is it? This pattern happens. I mean, you can't help but think of Putin when you talk about a chaotic situation. You know, the country was in a real mess, people craving for stability. And Putin actually did quite a good job in providing that stability. And then you get kind of the building of the empire, the looking beyond, and in many other places.
And the sort of strange interweaving of that, how the French, the post-revolutionary France, became woven back into European establishment, and in many ways has led Europe, and the revolution that he in some ways rescued, in some ways destroyed, remains the sort of model of the modernist revolution and the modernist republic. The United States is built on many of the thoughts and the ideas and many of the people, in fact, went and into the founding of the USA after that. So
the power of the Marseillaise, that's the national anthem. It's quite beyond many other anthems.
Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So in the book, rather than simply sort of tell the story of Napoleon, what we tried to do was to look at what were the tactics of power that he exercised in order to get and hold this power, and can we come to understand him through his tactics and the way he embodied and practiced those tactics.
Mm-hmm.
And we identified a number of those, including his patronage and inheritance and use of fear and manipulation of the press and of multiple parties and so on. But there's a sort of wider thesis of this, which is a suggestion that we might come to understand other practitioners of power through their exercise, through their tactical excellences and failures, and successes.
Mm-hmm. And there's a kind of pattern of half of the power tactics are getting power to start with, and then the other four are hanging on to that power that you've got. And there's this turning point, this pivot, when you go between the two. And that probably happens to a lot of other leaders as well. They start off being sort of somehow positive or nurturing, or they're exciting and bringing stability.
Yeah, I'm thinking of Steve Jobs at the moment, and thinking about Steve Jobs. On the face of it, he's not the charisma kind of doesn't just, he's not a loud, extrovert, brilliant speaker. Like that's not the kind of charisma he had. His attachment to kind of an object of desire, and like his focus on getting things done, and being absolutely focused to kind of create something which is different, which was kind of unique. That made him leap ahead of the field, didn't it? It's kind of that real desire to kind of create something, and the capacity to have tactics to make it happen as well.
Yes, yes. And I think in that, in the startup and the rebirth of Apple, there was also a powerful meritocracy people were given authority and resources really on the basis of their ability proven almost day by day.
Yeah.
You know, as things went by. And the old hierarchies around seniority and all those things. I mean, if you compare that with IBM at the time, which was a classic hierarchy organization, and the sort of Apple culture was so, it probably still is in some ways, at least the public image is based around that.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, that great advert they did on the for the Super Bowl when very famous advert, people should look it up. They spent all their marketing budget like on one advert, and it was about kind of a revolution, basically. This is a kind of a revolution against the existing order. And I thought, you know, yeah, that was in his mind. This is what we're doing. This is the object of desire. We're not just building a computer. It's like something else we're doing.
Yeah, I met the headhunter who moved John Sculley from Pepsi to Apple, because I did a lot of research about recruitment and headhunting and worked in that field. And this chap said to Sculley, "Do you want to spend the rest of your life selling sugared water, or do you want a chance to change the world?"
Yeah, yeah.
It's very appealing.
Yeah. There's this issue around people often talk about the leaders, but there's this saying, we get the leaders we deserve. And
that was Alistair Mant, wasn't it?
I'm just again thinking about kind of what throws up leaders at different times, and kind of what, you know, what can we think about in organizations around, rather than just thinking about kind of a leader with a psychological bent for doing stuff, can we kind of think about the context which leaders emerge within?
Well, definitely the revolution in France. There's the idea that the revolutions eat their children.
Yeah. But I'm thinking about organizational, you know, there's a lot of thought about organizational culture and kind of what you know, what creates the spaces for the kind of leadership which is not tyrannical, not messianic. What can we learn from Napoleon, like the lessons which we don't want to kind of follow? We can create other spaces for another kind of leadership to emerge.
Yes, I think the revolution was in some ways a time of fervent experimentation in many different kinds of leading, and people taking their own authority and being amazed by how effective that could be, and getting organized and uniting with others and having a fabulous time recreating the new kinds of ways of making decisions, new laws and abandoning old laws and so on. And then, of course, spilling more and more. What about justice? Let's have a go at that. And of course, the terror emerged as something which then became, once the sort of urges and desires to put right any small wrong and to abandon any kind of formalized bureaucratic procedures of justice, when simply, you know, a kind of urge to revenge or to punish a slight of some kind, you know, became an almost unanswerable. I mean, maybe there, you know, there are some parallels with the more extreme ends of identity politics these days, that you know, a slight on one's identity or one's choices in life or one's sort of belonging, one's membership, any of these kind of things is taken to be so absolute, not subject to any other kind of procedure, is itself if you say we've got to think about that, or we need evidence, or we've got to judge it against something else, that is in itself evidence of collusion with the offence in the first place. And I think this got really carried away in the terror. And that, and it is interesting to think, what, how does one come back from that kind of highly individualized identity-based notion of justice, and maybe a messianic escape is one of the few, you know, perhaps that's another part of what we see happening in the US and other places.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting. I was thinking about the political correctness and the wokeness and all the dialogue around that, around identity politics. And I was also thinking about one thing really has always interested me is how little is spoken about the English Revolution. It's like we hear a lot about the French Revolution, but 100 years or so before was the English Revolution in the 1650s. And again, it was like a time of radical chaos. There was radical egalitarian thoughts. People could read for the first time. There's the printing press made the Bible accessible and pamphlets accessible. And you had the Quakers and the Levellers and all these kind of small groups striving for to kind of create the kingdom on earth and to create equality and egalitarian idealistic. And then Cromwell's part of that. And then Cromwell becomes a messianic leader or a tyrant. And then he goes for his legacy and his dynasty and tries to get his son. You know, it's a similar pattern, isn't it?
Yeah, and initially, because Cromwell can say, oh, no, I don't want to be like a king. Yeah. But it's almost like that scene in Monty Python where, you know, he opens the shutters and he's standing there naked and all the crowd say, the Messiah. And it's like everybody wants a leader. They're not prepared to be a leader themselves, but they are so desperately looking for a leader that they'll pick on whoever appears to them to be of that style or his present. And I remember that clip being shown in a leadership conference and thinking, actually, it's really powerful.
Yeah, it is. And that link, but it's interesting, the link between sort of egalitarian revolutions, democratic revolutions, kind of which turn into something else, like the turning, you know, the turning from idealism to tyranny. I think that's
like in the Russian Revolution as well,
yeah,
with Stalin's emergence and when Lenin died and carefully jostling into positions of power. And that book by Isaac Deutscher about Stalin, I remember I was fascinated when I was, you know, I was just an A-level student, but it was the way that you get to these positions of power. And it can be done without the apparent powerful leaders even noticing.
Yeah, and people's desires change as well. I mean, if we think from psychoanalytic kind of positions of desire, you know, human beings are vessels of desire. You know, it separates us from kind of many other non-humans, and our desires shape kind of our, not only our individual kind of selves, but our social selves. And that, you know, a question I ask in my coaching and consulting work at the moment is kind of, what is your desire? Because it seems to me that our desires are dissipated, or we try and hack them and shortcut them, and we don't ponder enough on what is our desires. And if we don't do that, then something else happens. Something else a shadow can come up and usurp us. We can find our desires taken over by something else.
Yes, I think that probably is a point that came across very well in that Napoleon film, that his desires, you know, over time, he really did have the nerve to sort of carry it through and act on those desires. There's a point. One of the things that said in that very first opening scene where he's fighting he comes to reorganize the siege at Toulon and says, come on, we can take this fortress, and goes for it. And he writes in his own letters at that time that that his desire for action to really feel the blade of the sword, in a sense, was a sort of physical driving desire of his to be in the thick of it. And you saw that repeated throughout the movie. And then in the coup, the coup d'etat scene, which I think also was very powerfully done, actually, and quite well represented how
probably accurate
how he'd gone in, and his brother, who was a council member, was trying to chair the session, and he came in and tried to speak to them and say, come on, let's get organized around here. And they simply mobbed him and attacked him as they thought, they weren't wrong, actually, that he was part of a kind of military conspiracy of some sort. But he, when having been beaten up and kicked out and brushed down by his brother, who was there with the police, said, right, let's go for it, and went in with the army. I think it wasn't planned to be like that, but in the chaos of that moment, he could see somehow through all that chaos a path to action. And it could, so many times these things could have gone wrong. He could have got hurt, but he just wanted it and he went for it.
Interesting. What other lessons did you draw from Napoleon in your book? I know you kind of listed a few things of lessons around leadership and power. What other aspects have you thought about?
Well, one bit that comes across very clearly in his career and to some extent in the book is how when he became emperor, he put this out to the vote, to the public vote, and in so doing, sort of bypassed all the chattering classes and the military hierarchy and the diplomatic corps and anybody else who thought they might have some right to decide on the constitution and how we would arrange things, and simply took it to the popular vote. And this populist move was, for him, hugely successful, disastrous for France. For people, absolutely disastrous, but successful for him. And of course, we've seen that happen so many times since then. And of course, we're living in a time of rising populism ourselves. And I think looking at Napoleon, I think the movie doesn't really give enough context to that, about what, again, a risky but tremendously energetic kind of move it was to say, right, we're going to do this in a different way. And of course, he manipulated the votes as best he could, and he was he had a whole lot of fake, but they did, the fakes didn't change the outcome in terms of the electorate, fairly elected, I think.
I was quite interested in this concept of patronage, whereby you rewarded your followers, but it didn't actually necessarily get you loyalty to continue fighting for you. Because, okay, the lots of the aristocracy had gone into exile or been guillotined. So a lot of Napoleon's officers were not necessarily from the social class that were officers before. But when they he gave them land, he gave them houses, he gave them money. But then they started to feel differently, and they wanted to sort of, keep their money and enjoy their houses and enjoy the social class, the new aspirations that they had and their wives had. So it actually had a reverse effect, because they actually just wanted a quiet life then and to enjoy the goodies. And Napoleon just wanted to go back to battle, back to war again.
Yeah.
So patronage is quite a difficult tool to manage, a difficult tactic. It doesn't always work for the longer term.
No. And, the question again of charismatic leaders, messiah leaders, we hear a lot about their followers and their become disciples and become dependent, but that can be quite fragile as well. Like Napoleon's personality, the followership can also be a fragile thing, can't it?
Yeah. This was another really of his tactics, was recognizing people's position, constantly changing positions as followers of him or as of other factions. And we call this a tactic of manipulation. And some of it is divide and rule, very definitely. And some of it is what you would call, Simon, in your leadership modes, would be control. He really recognized, okay, let's get control of the press, let's get control of local government, let's the revolutionary removed the church officially, and he sort of re-established, first of all, church-like modes of local governance, and then and sort of reintegrated the church so that, well, for a number of reasons. One was to bring back a sense of order, a sense of loyalty and identity and things, but also to bring some as a sort of sanctity to his own position. Manipulate again this desire for almost suprahuman order, supernatural order, to justify himself. But one of the costs of this was that it became more and more evident to himself and others that he wasn't really leading for any particular principles. And we see that now, you know, once people get into power, the principled leadership, I'm here to put this particular, these sets of values into practice, gets worn away by the need to keep on board so many different interests and the constant compromises of governments and of any leaders, or most leaders in anything with a semblance of democracy to it, is really evidence of the constant practice of manipulation.
Yes, yeah. I'm kind of thinking about Nietzsche's work as well, as we talk about Napoleon and the Uberman. That kind of resonates quite a lot, doesn't it? His ideas of...
Yeah. I think he was the model for so many people, for the sort of romantic ideal of the individual who can rise above the constraints of nature and the body and all those things.
When he surrendered at Waterloo, Brits couldn't possibly let him come anywhere near Britain, because he could have raised, he could have convinced people in Britain who were sort of a bit hesitant, and who many of them thought, well, this liberty, equality, fraternity, it sounds pretty good to me. And the scene in the movie where he's talking to the midshipmen on board the Bellerophon, and they're fascinated. Well, of course they are. And, imagine going back and telling mum and dad, I met Napoleon. And he was so able to strike a chord with followers. And that there, his charisma, his messianic zeal was getting through to them. And then, of course, the the captain and Wellington, all that, were absolutely shocked. Well, get them all out of here rapidly before he can infect the whole crew.
Yeah. This has been a wonderful conversation. We're coming to an end of the podcast. And I asked my guests two questions. Thinking about your work on leadership and on Napoleon, any lessons to us about how we might live a good life or create a good society? Any thoughts?
I think I'd like to mention Napoleon's, all his administrative work as first consul, because that was powerful and it was overlooked in the movie. And the things like creating the Legion of Honour, which is still France's highest award. And this idea of striving for a recognised honour and being positive and looking for the best and having a legacy, which is one of the points that we talked about before. And nobody writes on their tombstone, I wish I'd spent longer at the office. It's achieving something which is recognised that you can work towards.
Thanks, Stephanie. Any thoughts, Jonathan?
I'd like to reflect more, encourage others also to reflect more on the tactics of power that they employ in, you know, particularly working relationships, or that they're being caught up in. I think it's rather than look at leaders as somehow extraordinary individuals or just as the outcomes of unconscious processes, both of which I'm sure are true in some respect, I think it's quite good to look at, you know, how do they do power? How do they do manipulation? How do they do charisma? How do they do whatever modes they use? Patronage is very common in almost all organizations. And I think it gives one a sense of power as sort of powering. It's a bit like watching a football match, and if you're coming to understand the different ways in which the different styles that people have of doing the various parts of defending and attacking and so on. And I think that allows one to watch this extraordinary world of power play a bit like you're in an art gallery or a movie cinema or something.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting. Well, I'd like to thank you both very much. It's been a very insightful and enjoyable conversation. And I'll see you along the way, no doubt. Take care.
Very good.
Thank you, Simon.
Definitely. Thanks, Jonathan. Bye now.
Yes, goodbye.